Hello and welcome to the Muni Lowdown. My name is Paul Graves and I'm the managing editor for Detwine Municipals. Today's podcast title is Charging Up. Joining me to discuss electric vehicles in the government space is Chuck Stanley, senior policy reporter covering the renewable energy transition for InfraLogic. Chuck, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks a lot, Paul. Thanks for having me.
And for full transparency, Chuck, I want to mention the fact that you used to work for us over at Detwine Munis, and then you transitioned over to InfraLogic. Tell us a little bit more about what you do for them.
Thanks a lot, Paul. I cover energy policy for SparkSpread, which is InfraLogic's daily newswire focused on the renewable energy transition. I cover policy matters coming out of Washington, D.C., from regulatory agencies to the major expenditures coming out of the Inflation Reduction Act and the bipartisan infrastructure law aimed at fueling the transition to renewable energy and decarbonizing the economy.
And I'll just clarify for our audience, InfraLogic / SparkSpread is a sister product to Debtwire. Chuck, let's get into an overview of where things stand with federal electric vehicle incentives and why this is an important issue for state and local governments.
Sure thing. So as part of President Biden's pledge to make the U.S. economy carbon neutral by 2050, the administration has passed a lot of major incentives aimed at accelerating the transition to electric vehicles. A lot of those incentives are found in the bipartisan infrastructure law and the major climate and renewable energy package passed last year, the Inflation Reduction Act. And those are primarily focused on reducing the purchasing cost for new electric vehicles and providing funding to lay the groundwork for a national charging network capable of assuring drivers that they'll be able to find a place to charge their vehicle once they get out on the road. The major impact for states and municipalities from those programs is that they're going to put money directly in the hands of state and local authorities to build out charging infrastructure in places where it's needed most. And the purchase incentives may also give public authorities with aging vehicle fleets the opportunity to lower their maintenance and fuel costs by transitioning earlier to newer electric vehicles with the help of that federal funding. I should also note here that with a few exceptions, most of these programs can and will apply to other low or zero emission vehicles and the related infrastructure, but the electric vehicle market is by far the most advanced of these. So in the early going, that's where most of this money is going to be spent.
And let's drill down a little bit further on the federal electric vehicle charging infrastructure funding that's been provided. Right now, that total pot is $7.5 billion. And of that $7.5 billion, $5 billion is going to states for the purposes of interstate highways and major transportation corridors. Can you speak a little bit more about that?
Absolutely. So yes, this is basically two major pots in the infrastructure law for building out charging infrastructure in the country. As you mentioned, there's a $5 billion formula funding portion, and that goes out to all 50 states, Puerto Rico, and Washington, D.C. Each state and territory and district among those had to submit a plan for deploying this infrastructure plan primarily along interstate highways, basically to ensure that drivers on long trips, if you're taking a road trip with your family or if you have to drive for work, that you're not going to run up against long stretches of highway where you can't find a place to charge your vehicle. Those plans have all been submitted, and that funding should be on the way out the door to those state, district, and territorial authorities.
And the remaining $2.5 billion is for community-level EV deployment, and EV just standing for electric vehicles moving forward. And it's disproportionately going to rural and low-income communities. Chuck, tell us more.
That's right. So this $2.5 billion, city, state, municipal agencies can get a little bit more creative with this. It's competitive funding. Individual authorities can send in their proposal to the feds for deployment of this EV infrastructure. And it really gives smaller jurisdictions the opportunity to shape how EV infrastructure is deployed at the local level. The main idea here is to establish the beginnings of a market that the private sector can expand on once demand reaches a level sufficient to support profitable charging stations. So as you mentioned, preference is given to rural, low-income, and high multifamily areas. These are communities that don't tend to have as much EV adoption. They don't tend to have as much access to public charging infrastructure. So if you're in a community where maybe you live in an apartment and you don't have a garage or a carport where you can charge your vehicle overnight, you're probably less likely to go out and buy an electric vehicle if you don't see charging infrastructure available near you or around you. Consequently, if that community doesn't have a certain level of adoption of EVs, if you're thinking of building public charging infrastructure somewhere, you're not going to go in an area where nobody owns electric vehicles. So it becomes this chicken and the egg problem that the federal government's really trying to address by giving local authorities access to this funding to build out sort of a baseline of infrastructure so that owners of EVs can feel confident they'll have a place to charge their vehicle.
So how long typically does it take to build an EV charging station?
It sounds like it can vary a lot. According to one developer I checked with, the actual installation for a public charging station can probably take a few weeks. But you have to add on to that a significant amount of planning and permitting, and that can stretch out to months or more than a year.
So from what I've read, there are two basic types of charging stations. One are those that provide a slower charge that can fully charge an empty battery over a span of 12 to 14 hours. And the other, fast charging stations that are much more expensive and require significantly more power, but can fully charge a vehicle in an hour or less. Is one of these options preferred by state and local governments? For example, are fast charging stations preferred on the highway and slower charge stations preferred for car fleets?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I mean, from, you know, the standpoint of user friendliness, faster is always going to be better, right? But those fast charging stations are significantly more expensive than the slower charging stations. I haven't seen anything specific about governments preferring one or the other, but I think intuitively you can imagine that there's going to be a stronger effort to procure these fast chargers along transit corridors and things like that, the public-facing chargers. Whereas if you're operating a fleet and you need charging infrastructure for that, it's probably a lot easier for you to leave cars while they're sitting idle, charging at a slower rate.
Is there any section of the country seeing the most growth in EV charging stations?
From what I've seen from the most recent Department of Energy numbers, California has the most public EV chargers, but the Northeast is the region of the country that's seeing the fastest growth right now.
So let's move the conversation over to the federal government's efforts to incentivize fleet electrification. Now, there are two pots of money I want to talk about concerning mass transit buses and school buses. With mass transit buses, there's about $5.6 billion allocated. And what's the goal there?
So this program is being billed by the Department of Transportation as a pilot program or funding for pilot programs to give local transit authorities the opportunity to basically provide proof of concept for the transition to zero emission transit bus fleets. So that money can go towards the actual bus purchases, which is going to be a significant cost if you're operating a transit system with a large bus fleet. But, you know, there's also other significant costs related to training, planning, support infrastructure that also has to go along to these transitions. So this money is available to support all of those costs.
And what about the $5 billion for school buses?
Right. This is another program that was included in the bipartisan infrastructure bill. It's kind of interesting in that it's operated by the Environmental Protection Agency. And the reason for that is that one of the main arguments in support of targeting money specifically towards transitioning school buses to cleaner fuel sources is that it'll have a significant impact on the exposure of kids to pollution from exhaust from school buses. A lot of those pollutants are being increasingly linked to long-term health impacts. So this is an area where Democrats actually wanted a lot more funding. And so even as we see the existing program go forward, I wouldn't be surprised to see future efforts to bring in more funding for this.
Let's now get into tax credits and how they're supposed to incentivize nonprofits, government agencies, and consumers to purchase electric vehicles.
Right. This is an interesting aspect of the Inflation Reduction Act for nonprofits and government agencies because it really gives them access to a lot of the clean energy credits, including tax credits for purchase of zero emission vehicles in the broader Inflation Reduction Act. The reason for that is that the way most of these credits are provided is through the tax code. And in most cases, if you're eligible for these tax credits, you can't use them to basically give yourself a negative tax bill, which means if you're a consumer like yourself or myself and you're able to access these tax credits, but your personal tax bill is essentially zeroed out through other credits, you can't use it to take a payment from the government. The IRA made an exception for municipal governments and nonprofit agencies, which of course don't have a tax bill for the year. And what that means is that they can monetize these credits and offset the significant upfront costs for purchasing EVs or any of the other renewable energy credits. That's really important because the upfront cost for gas and diesel vehicles is generally lower than electronic vehicles. But over time, lower fuel costs and maintenance costs mean the ownership of EVs is lower. So for a lot of public vehicle fleets, these tax credits will probably incentivize whichever entity owns them to begin cycling out their older vehicles a little sooner than they otherwise might so that they can enjoy those savings with a lower upfront cost.
And Chuck, are there any cybersecurity concerns around electric vehicle infrastructure and charging stations?
You know, I think that's going to be an issue with any sort of highly networked critical system. We're seeing this as an area of concern already throughout the bulk power system. We've seen issues with it, private and public entities that have been subjected to ransomware attacks. So I think it's certainly going to be on the minds of regulators and operators of these systems. I think another big challenge for state and local authorities is going to be just managing the dramatic change in both the production and consumption side of the energy grid. I mean, we're talking about electrifying multiple large power-hungry segments of the economy that currently rely on fossil fuels. And that not only increases demand on the grid, but it also changes where and when those demand spikes are likely to occur. At the same time, we're transitioning to a more distributed and variable energy generation fleet. And that has the potential to be more resilient than the old system in some ways, but it's also going to require a lot of adaptation. So managing that transition on both sides of the grid is going to be a big part of the story.
Well, Chuck, it seems like there's a lot going on when it comes to electric vehicles and charging station infrastructure. Let me ask you one last question. From your perspective, is this something you see taking hold over the next 10, 20 years? 30 years, longer time, shorter time? What's your view on it?
You're already seeing major automakers pledge to phase out sales of new internal combustion engine vehicles over the next 10 or 15 years. So, I mean, I think we're going to see a transition where the uptake is gradual and then really picks up steam over maybe 5 or 10 years. So I can see it kind of snowballing. How that's going to play out with the development of public charging infrastructure is another big question because there's no telling exactly how consumers are going to want to access these charging resources, whether they'll operate in the same way that gas service stations are working now, whether they'll be more prominent at places where people spend more time to allow for that additional charging time. It really remains to be seen. And I think the market's going to tell the story and private investment is going to follow as time goes on and as we know more about how consumers prefer to use these.
Well, Chuck, we'll be counting on you to keep us posted and up to date with the developments in the charging infrastructure space. Thanks, Chuck, for coming on the podcast.
Thanks a lot, Paul. I appreciate you having me on.
To our audience, I hope you found this podcast to be informative. And please support us by liking, sharing, and/or subscribing to Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Until the next time, thanks for joining us on the Muni Lowdown. The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are solely those of the host and guests. They do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of ION Analytics or any affiliated entities. The information shared in this podcast is for general informational purposes and should not be considered as professional advice.